So we're going to start out with just a couple of minutes of creating a separation between, you know, our morning and then now. So just bring your attention to your breathing, and then we'll do the prayers in a couple of minutes. But let everybody settle down, including me. So just bring your awareness to the breathing. Now, it is helpful to count, particularly those of us that are new. Sit up straight, and that's the key instruction, of course, is to keep your spine straight. Although, ultimately, this sounds crazy, but ultimately, you'd like to be able to have the mind of meditation. In other words, just sort of very perceptive mind that's paying attention and can analyze every moment and see the truth of reality in every moment, whether you're lying, standing, sitting, or walking. But in the beginning, we just try to learn how to do it sitting. It's a good start. And if you count your breath like up to 21, and so Geshe-la's taught this many times, it's kind of weird. You go out and in is one. Out and in is two. So try to count up to 21 silently. And a couple of things to think about before we get started. One is impermanence. That for any spiritual practice, it said that remembering how things are in a constant state of flux on a microscopic level. So, you know, like sometimes we say in a finger snap, like 64 mind moments. Some people, you know, in some traditions, they say millions of mind moments in a microsecond. But in any case, the mind is in a constant state of flux. It's very, and there's gross impermanence too, which is like, you know, we got up this morning, some people will die today, things will happen that are different, and that are, you know, it's just this growth. Anybody can recognize that impermanence, but the subtle impermanence of the mind and body always going on, unrecognized. But very important to tune into that. So remembering impermanence at the beginning of the practice, and during the middle of the practice, and at the end of the practice, is said to bring some intensity to it, rather than just a lackadaisical, kind of casual. Somebody in here could die in the Kadampa Center. It could be you. It could be any one of us. It could happen any moment. That's how life is so transient, so precious. Could end any moment. Got to take the essence of it right now. Don't waste it. Don't waste your life in gazing meaningless activities. And the other thing to turn the mind to before we start is called the awakening mind, and it's the heart of Mahayana Buddhism. It's for example, if we only wanted to practice for our own happiness, we wouldn't practice. We would practice the so-called individual vehicle, the Theravada practices, and the only three things you got to get. For this, one is you have to practice ethics, you have to develop a concentrated mind, and you have to develop wisdom. You get these three things, then you achieve nirvana, which is, you know, the word nirvana gets tossed around a lot, but it just means freedom from suffering. When you take away suffering, the nature of the mind is total joy and bliss. So if you just want joy and bliss for you, then that's the practice for you. If you want to practice for others, in other words, your goal for achieving joy and bliss and developing, you know, compassion and wisdom and loving kindness and skillful means, all the qualities that we think of as connected to Buddhahood, then our goal is full enlightenment. Why do I want to become enlightened? Why do I want to achieve all of these great mind states and to find, you know, this lasting, amazing peace and happiness of a Buddha? The only reason to do that is because you want to help others. Otherwise, you would have gotten off the train at the stop called Nirvana, but you stayed on the train to Buddhahood. Okay? That's really a big and important distinction. As much as we can, even though it is not natural, and it's in the beginning, it's clearly effortful, we set our goal on helping others, serving others in every conceivable, possible, imaginable way. And how do we get to the point where we can effectively serve others? We have to get our own act together. So we develop, we say, okay, I want to help others, I want to lead them to full enlightenment, but I don't have it. I don't have it together yet. I've got to get my life together. So we practice this path called a Mahayana path. Usually we think of it as the Lam Rim or the stages of the path. Very clearly laid out, practical step-by-step method to transform our mind from wherever we are now, from our current state of confusion and maybe depression, anxiety, stress, things are not going that well at home, at work, wherever you are, there is hope. There is hope, but it means you have to do a lot of work. It's not quick. This is not the easy way. This is the effortful way of transforming the mind from confusion to like supreme happiness. And it is possible, and it's been done. You won't be the first person to achieve enlightenment when you get there. Many beings have done it before. Again, this motivation, I must become enlightened in order be of the greatest possible service to all living beings and lead them from confusion to supreme happiness. That's my purpose for practice. That's the purpose of my life. As much as possible. That's how we need to train ourselves to think. Let's turn to page 34 in the prayer book, and we'll read, we'll just read the first 34 and page 34 and 35 in English. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary being. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha fill and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radham Mandala Kamne Yatayami. Now, at this point, we do some mantras. I need the Om Se to lead us in the tune, because I have my tune. I get confused with the different. Well, I'll do my tune. We'll do the tune for Chinrezig. Sounds like the New Christy Minstrels, but it's different than the one we did. Oh, yeah, okay, ready? It goes like this. Om Mani Padme Hum, 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. One more time. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. And then the Torah tune that I like is, you can just listen to the first round. Let me see if I can remember it. Om Dare Du Dare Du Re Soha. 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 Out of sinus infection. Okay. So, those are all the prayers until we get at the end, we'll do dedication prayers. Today, the subject of discussion, Sarah dropped this on me last week, said, "Hey, Don, nobody wants to do Sunday. Would you like to do it?" So, I can talk. I can talk about some things, but I thought, you know, what would be really interesting is to talk about what you're interested in, instead of have my agenda and come up with some, you know. In fact, how many people have ever been to a Zen retreat? Anybody ever been to a Zen retreat? No. Anyway. At a Zen retreat, I've been quite a few Zen retreats, and one of my teachers, her name is Sherry Huber. She's so amazing, and she says, "Okay, what's going on with you?" You know, because you want to start where the people are, not kind of feed them stuff. But she says, "Okay, what's going on with you?" And then she'll just be quiet. And if nobody, she says, "Well, if nobody says anything, we'll just sit here quietly for an hour." But anyway, there's this great book, Dear Lama's Radical Solutions for Transforming Problems into Happiness. But this thing goes from everything from losing your job, to healing, to killing, to God, to George Bush, to drugs, to divorce, to disability, depression, clairvoyance, babies, attachment, animals, AIDS. Anyway, just everything, spirit, sickness, religion, relationships, that's a big one, isn't it? So anyway, he has lots of things to say about it, but I thought I'd kind of hang on to this and see if anything is useful. But, you know, I've been studying, just a lot of people here don't know me, I've been studying Buddhism for a long time, but I'm not a guru. I've been doing this since 1978, but I do have some experience teaching introductory classes and answering, you know, and also trying to live with an awareness of this, so I can I'll do my best to try to answer any questions, and I promise I won't make anything up. Well, I'll do my best not to, and if I run out of answers, I'll defer to our Venerable Robbie Watkins over here, the center director. But anyway, so anything going on? Any burning issues or questions or problems or anything about your life or Buddhism or in general? And I think what I'll do is try to answer it with a Dharma spin, whatever is going on. Or we'll just sit here. So I'm fine with that too. I'd prefer that. No, I'm kidding. Oh, Do we need a microphone or no? Is this being, this thing could be streamed to as many as one other, might be at least one person out there. Robbie usually says millions of people around the world, but I'm not that optimistic. Thank you.
I struggle with the concept of no self, because it seems to me there has to be a conventional self who has past lives and future lives, who is the decision maker that creates positive and negative karma, who is experiencing the results of his or her own and not somebody else's past actions.
Yeah.
To say that this self is not unchanging and permanent is fine, but it is continuing over a very long time if we have thousands of lives.
Mm-hmm. So how does that, I mean, does that create a problem for you? Like, how does that affect your, is that more of an intellectual question, or is that a real problem for you in your day-to-day life? Like, how does it show up as an issue, or does it?
Well, I have difficulty with the teaching of no self,
mm-hmm.
with emptiness as it is taught, because it seems to me there has to be a self.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, some people actually get a little freaked out by that, you know, and about what you're talking about is what I would call kind of a nihilistic view, like there is no self. And Buddhism doesn't say that, doesn't say there isn't a self. Clearly, you know, there's a self. Like over there, I'm seeing a form, a body, and you have a mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we call those the body and mind. We call those the aggregates, the body and mind. Sometimes it's broken down into five aggregates where there's a form and then there's the, one of them is form and then there's four mental aggregates. But it's just body and mind. Those is a collection of two things, the body and mind. And based on that, we label you a person. And you can label yourself a self. And that's all there is. It's just the mere label self. The self that's being negated in Buddhism is called it's this reified sense of self. You know, this exaggerated, reified is a good word, hardwired sense of self. You know, it's the self that exists. It's everything beyond the mere label self, okay? And that doesn't exist. The merely labeled self has existed forever and will continue to exist, and it's what actually goes from lifetime to lifetime. But this whole concept of, you think about it, I mean, there's like, and we can experience it at different times, you know, more or less, more powerfully, like when you get really angry at somebody, how big does the self seem then? It seems like it's big as a mountain, doesn't it? It's like, you know, and we, so here's what Buddhism would say. We project with our mind, and it's a habit, the habit that's been going on a very, very, very long time, okay? It's a habit. We project a false sense of self that is beyond the merely labeled self. Everything beyond the merely labeled self is a false sense of self. We project this false sense of self. We believe in it. We believe it's true. And then we cling to it. That's the problem. We cling to this false sense of self. Then, when somebody says, you're a jerk, and you've got a belief that I'm a nice person, I'm not a jerk, what do? You get angry. Because somebody just attacked me, right? I. Or when somebody says, oh, you're so wonderful, you're so beautiful, you're so this, you're so that. You know, we go, oh, I love that, you know, and I want more of that. Give me more of that kind of, again, it's that, it's the same self, the sense of self, the thought sense of self that we are empty of, okay? This is the in the view of emptiness. That's the false sense of self that we say we're empty of. Now, that's a weird term, isn't it? Emptiness. But you can think of it like this. I love the example of if I said that there was a bank, if everybody was outside the room, okay? And I said, okay, and I turned on a tape recorder. I had like the sound of a Bengal tiger on my cell phone, and I turned it up really loud, and you can hear the roars and everything. And everybody was outside. I said, okay, now be careful. There's a Bengal tiger, tiger in the Kadampa Center, in the Gompa. So everybody would like come in very carefully, and you really believe there was one there, right? This is like the false sense of self. You really believed that there was a Bengal tiger there, just like we really believe in this false projected sense of self. But you go in there and you look for it, and you think, gosh, all I see is this cell phone here making this noise. I cannot find that tiger. And you look everywhere. You don't just assume because you walk in you can't see it. You mentally, you have to prove to yourself that it's not real. So you go look under the cabinets and everywhere, and it's not hiding anywhere. Then you go and you say, well, there's no Bengal tiger here. The room is empty of Bengal tiger. You could say that, couldn't you? Just like we're empty of this false projected sense of self. So this is weird, because what we're saying, the ultimate reality of who we are is the voidness of something that we thought was real. There's the emptiness of self. This is called self. It's similar. Selflessness, not exactly the same thing, but it's almost exactly the same thing. That self that we thought exists, we hold on to, and I mean, you think about it. It identity's tied into it. I'm a man. I'm a woman. I'm smart. I'm stupid. I'm beautiful. I'm ugly. I'm old. I'm young. I got a job. I don't have a job. I'm depressed. I. Our whole life and all of our suffering has one cause. This mistaken sense of self, which the Buddha said we're void of. We're empty of that self. That self doesn't exist in anywhere in space or in reality. It's a fiction. Just like that Bengal tiger in the room was not true. The room is empty of Bengal tiger. We're empty of that false sense of self. Do we exist? Yes. As a mere collection of body and mind. And can you function like that? You're darn right. That's how a Buddha functions. And then when that is all that you perceive yourself of as a body and mind that's in a constant state of flux, if somebody criticizes you or something good or bad happens, you know, it's like no big deal. Because they're not complimenting me, they're complimenting their projection of who I am. And they're not criticizing me, they're criticizing their projection of who they think I am. That's their problem. What you think about me is not my business. I like that. So it is a tricky subject in Buddhism. But when you really get down to the nitty-gritty of it, where the rubber meets the road, and let's make it practical, right? Because, you know, what you've discussed, what we're talking about is kind of like an intellectual exercise. But you can see how important it is, can't you? Because attachment, anger, fear, jealousy, pride, all the negative mind states that you can ever imagine are predicated on this false sense of I. Everything depends on you, you know, how dare they treat me this way? I want that. You know, we talk about this. We're addicted to pleasure, deliciousness, and we dread anything that's not pleasurable. Well, I want this. I don't want that. And it's more than just I want it. I really want it. We cling to deliciousness, and we cling, or you could say we repulse, which is negative attachment, isn't it? I'm attached to not having anything that's not delicious. So I. all of our suffering is predicated on a big, big cosmic mistake. That we think we're somebody special, and we're not. As Ajahn Buddhadasa says, there's nothing worth being or having. Interesting. Now that doesn't mean we shouldn't get up in the morning and go to work, but there's nothing worth being or having. Because there is no, inherent, existent, concrete I. Now, again, practical, practical, practical. How is this practical? First of all, it's practical because we know where this is the devil, okay? It was right in our heart. It's called selfish self-centeredness, isn't it? So anytime an action's motivated by selfish self-centeredness, always going to lead to suffering. That's useful to know. Anytime we do something motivated out of selfish self-centeredness, according to the laws of what goes around comes around, and again, karma is not easy to understand, but it is the heart of spiritual practice, is that you have to have some degree of faith in the fact that whatever you do with your body, speech, and mind, ultimately it's the mental factor. Whatever we do will come back to us in spades. So if we harm others, it comes back to us in harm. We get harmed. We go, I don't deserve to be treated this way. Well, you've treated other people this way. It's coming back to you. We're not a victim, ever, according to the laws of karma. And when we're kind, even the slightest action of kindness, generosity, like giving a morsel of food to an animal, again, that comes back to us in the form of some kind of positive, happy experience. So karma is crucial. Now, when we get down to the nitty-gritty of how karma and emptiness work together, it's very important never, ever to think that your actions don't have consequences. It's not that is inappropriate. In fact, the whole proof of emptiness is that things depend. There's no concrete independent existence out there. Everything is dependent on a mind that labels it, isn't it? It's dependent on causes and conditions. It's dependent upon parts. So, the nature of reality is that things are dependent, not independent. That independent sense of I is a fiction. We've kind of proved that. So the proof of that is that everything exists independent upon causes and conditions. That's one of them. But the subtlest is that everything depends upon the mind that labels it. Okay, so we're creating our own reality, whether it's 64 microseconds in a snap of a finger, that we're creating a reality, or whether it's a billion karmas ripening in, the time it takes you to blink your eye. But constantly, we are creating our reality with our mind. Where is that coming from? Where is the projection? It's like a projector in our head. Where is it coming from? We're all having a different experience of life, aren't we? Not everybody. Some people are men, some people are women, some people are happy, some people are sad, some people have an easy life, some people have a hard life. Where is all that coming from? We're all, even right now, everybody has a different experience of this, of me, of this. We're all having a different experience. But we're all sort of slightly arrogant in thinking that our view of everything in this room is the way it is. And it's not. It's just my view. Everybody's having my life view of reality. You got that? It's not. We're not all having the same experience, right? It's pretty obvious. Where is that coming from? Where is my experience coming from? If there is no fixed, concrete reality out there, where is it coming from? It's coming from karma ripening every microsecond. Billions of karmic seeds ripening, forcing you this morning to your good, based because of all your past good karma, I will say, forcing you to see yourself at Kadampa Center, forcing you to hear about these teachings on emptiness and karma. Right? That's what, you know, your karma's ripening for you to have this experience. All right, now if you're enjoying this experience, what created that? A positive action in the past. Your virtuous behavior in the past has created karma for you to be happy right now, for you to have a positive mind, and for you to sort of see this as a positive experience. Now, if you're like, if you think this is a and maybe it is, but if you think this is a bunch of hooey and you're suffering, you know, and maybe you have a lot of physical pain in your body, but whatever your perception of yourself and this place in the moment, let's just say it's unhappy and miserable. Where's that coming from? Where's that coming from? We would say that comes from past non-virtue. That's what causes the unhappy mind. It's past non-virtue. So one, and this is a poor man's way of thinking about it, but I really think it helps our minds to see that, you know, there, Lama Zopa says, one of our teachers says, the reality that's out there is so subtle, it's as if there's nothing out there. Because we say everything depends upon the mind that labels it, right? There's no concrete reality that exists independent of my mind. There's like, there's nothing out there that exists independent of my mind. My mind, it's a dynamic process. So, so subtle. What's out there is so, so subtle. It's as if our mind is creating everything. It's as if our mind is creating everything. So, let's just imagine for our own purposes that there's literally like a big movie screen out there. Right? It's like a big movie screen. And our mind is projecting life as you see it. Man, woman, happy, sad, beautiful, ugly, old, you know, whatever. Whatever the adjectives are that you perceive yourself as. Depressed, you know, whatever, stressed, happy, all of that. Okay. What, you know, all of that is just flooding into our mind at every moment. We are projecting our life. We are creating. Who's the God? And you know, if you want to talk about the creator, it's your own karma. That's the creator of our experience. Our own past actions ripening in the moment to force us to have the experience of happiness or misery. Now, this is kind of interesting. Now we're really talking, because this is how we can find happiness. This is how we can literally shape our mind, how we can shape our reality. Because there is no objective inherent existence out there independent of my mind labeling it, and the labels come from my own former actions, you know, it's not, when we understand how the mind works, it's just logical. You wouldn't want to hurt anybody, would you? Because it just comes back to you. You would not kill. You would not steal. You would not commit adultery or behave in harmful ways sexually. You wouldn't lie. You wouldn't badmouth people, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous speech, greed, hatred, ignorance. 84,000 delusions, right? There are many, but these are the top 10 kind of things. Wouldn't do that. Because, you know, we might as well just take a gun and shoot ourselves in the foot. Literally, we're harming ourselves. Why would I, it's like drinking poison. Why do I want to poison myself? We've been doing that since beginningless time, since beginningless rebirth. So the Buddha's saying, look, wake up. Stop harming yourself and others. Wake up. And so what's the cause of me to be, I mean, if you're having a pleasant experience today, and, you know, whatever's going on with you is, your mind's happy. In this moment, there's a cause for your mind to be happy. It's some former action. Some former action which we call virtue. Which, generally speaking, is avoiding killing, avoiding stealing, avoiding sexual misconduct, avoiding lying, slander, harsh, frivolous, greed, hatred, ignorance. But it's also practicing virtue, creating positive karma. So, a really smart Buddhist becomes like a junkie for good karma. because they understand. For example, if they, you know, that generosity is the cause, maybe not, and it might not ripen in this lifetime. So that's kind of the, you can't like, oh, I'm going to Kadan, I'll go out to the donation box, and please, if you want to do this, feel free to, but I'm going to write a check for $1,000 because I need some money next week, you know, to pay my rent, and it'll, my karma will ripen in me, and I'll get like $2,000 back. It doesn't work that way. Next lifetime, most of the karma that we create in this life will ripen in future lifetimes. So, again, being generous with the view of karma would be, well, I'm going to give without attachment because I'm not going to get anything from this, but I understand that it is the cause of abundance and wealth, okay? And being kind, you can see it. I mean, people who are kind, even in this lifetime, generally, people like to be around kind people, don't they? And I mean, if somebody, if you're even a room, even dogs don't like to be around mean people. Forget about other people, you know? So, being mean and harming yourself too, by the way. We need to pay attention to this one. How do we beat ourselves? Look at what we do to ourselves. It's just pathetic. We beat ourselves up. We're very critical of ourselves. Constantly putting ourselves down, comparing ourselves to all these Ralph Lauren models. Or whatever magazine. You just open the magazines these days and there's all these beautiful people that have been photoshopped. So they're really not as beautiful as they seem, but maybe they are. But, you know, it's, we constantly criticize and put ourselves down. And that negative self-talk, it's just as destructive as doing something to somebody else. You know, it comes back to us. It becomes a habit. You know, getting angry, people think, well, I'll get, you know, I have this anger inside. I have to get it out. Well, try that. Go ahead and let your anger out. See what happens. Everybody gets away from you. Nobody wants to be around you now. You know, people like move away, give you some space, because they don't know if you're going to pull out a gun or blow yourself up or whatever. And furthermore, it just creates the habit to be really good at expressing your anger. And that's not even anger. Yelling is not anger. Flailing around and even punching somebody is not angry. It's not anger, is it? That's not anger. Those are actions of body and speech. That's not anger. I could punch somebody out of compassion. Really. I could. Or I could yell at somebody, like my kids running in the street, you know, running out in the street. And I go, stop! You know, it would look like anger, but no. I mean, you can, so anger is a state of mind, isn't it? It's a state of mind. And so, again, if we want to suffer, Don't police, if we don't care about our future, just keep on doing what you've been doing. Let your mind run amok. Let's follow our instincts, whatever feels good, you know, whatever is instinctive. Forget about, you know, just follow the dictum of the ego. We're addicted to deliciousness, so let's just keep going for that. That looks like the purpose of life is to have as much fun as you can while you can, so let's just go for it, you know? You know, go get loaded, you know, do. You know, sometimes people say we're human doings, not human beings. You know, but it's very practical. Very practical advice to see that that how we behave ethically ties into this whole notion of emptiness. Because things are empty of any inherent, concrete, independent existence, it depends upon causes and conditions and a mind that labels it. And the labels and the conditioning are called karma. And karma depends upon virtue and non-virtue. Virtue is non-harming. You know, non-virtue is harming. Now, in the moment, this gets to another practical point. Well, how do you know when you're being virtuous? Because, you know, you might think, well, my family's starving. I'm going in the Harris Teeter, and I'm stealing a turkey, you know, or I'm stealing stuff, food or money, or I'm going to do whatever I want to do. I'm not going to pay my taxes. I'm going to lie. I'm going to do whatever I need to do, you know. And we can justify that. We can justify anything. You know, we are very good at justifying our non-virtuous behavior. But it doesn't work out. It doesn't work out. It always backfires. It always backfires. So in the moment, even though we think we might be doing something virtuous, if we don't examine our mind, we'll never know. And the way we know that this is really important, because see, remember I said, an act of generosity, you go give if you write a check for $100 and drop it in the box and make sure everybody sees you so they'll think you're such a great person and that you're so generous. Well, your motivation was wrong, wasn't it? It was because you wanted, you know, even though you're acting generous and it will ripen in some future lifetime as you know, wealth, it's weakened by your motivation for having other people like you. So the key factor in karma is your motivation, your intention. I'm using these words interchangeably, but they're not exactly the same thing. But the key thing to notice, if we want to learn how to shape our mind and live in accordance with this reality called emptiness, we have to know every moment what our motivation is. You know, I'm doing this, am I doing it for selfish reasons, or am I doing it for others? Genuinely doing it for others, okay? Not just thinking. Is my mind motivated by self-cherishing? Is my motivated cherishing oneself, greed, hatred, ignorance, whatever, you know, So the way to know that your action is going to lead to happiness is that it's motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance. Every action motivated by that will rebound to you according to the laws of karma, like that boomerang, come back as happiness. So now we're really talking about how to practice every moment. We can never take a vacation. As Buddhists, you know, you might be able to go on vacation, but we can't take a vacation from our mind and from this whole process of causation, causality. Every moment we need to be noticing, is this action of body, speech, and mind motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance? If it is, I'm creating the causes to be forced to see myself in paradise and happy. If my actions are motivated by greed, hatred, or ignorance, the karmic boomerang will come back and I'll be forced to see myself as suffering. It's just, you know, it's just so practical. It really comes down, even though God said do this and that, in Buddhism we say, look, it's in our own self-interest to not hurt other people. And to, you know, you get into the checkout line at Harris Teeter and they give you too much money, you give them the money back. Because you don't want to shoot yourself in the foot, you know. We look for opportunities to practice virtue. For example, Kadamba Center, you know, this is like a merit, volcanic merit factory, you know, where there's so many opportunities. I'm promoting this a little bit, but you know, walking around the stupa, making offerings, helping out, you know, sweeping the floor, doing things to keep this particular center open so that it continue to provide these teachings is a huge contribution and creates a lot of, if your motivation is good, creates a lot of positive merit. So it's kind of like that. So we need to think about merit and creating positive merit and not creating negative karma or negative merit. So it's not negative merit, but negative karma. Was that one answer?
Yes.
Holy moly.
Thank you.
All right. Pandora's box. Sorry for that one person watching on the streaming or not. It may not be anybody. Yeah. Good.
Using that word practicality in your soliloquy. This, what's on my mind is the fact that this path is so incredibly rich. It's so much to it. And so being practical about it, incorporating it into my days, because there's a morning session, there's a night session, and then there are the classes. Right now I'm in the basic program. It's a lot of studying, and then you see these side things that you want to learn too, so you're into that. And then there's work, everyday life, whatever you're doing to sustain yourself. So my question is, could you give me an idea about incorporating it all into your life without becoming a nun?
I was getting ready to say become a nun, but
no. But actually, I keep having these dreams that I'm a nun, and yeah. I'm looking down, and I'm thinking, Donna. I keep thinking the next time I dream this, I'm gonna look down and see what I'm wearing. What's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I want to be a nun, but. Like I said, it's so rich, and it seems like it just takes over my whole life. And to the point that the other things just kind of grow strangely dim. I'm not that interested in it anymore. I'm interested in this, but trying not to be greedy and grabbing at this and grabbing at that, and I'm not grabbing so much anymore because it's just so much information, and it's so absolutely delicious, but I need practicality.
I hear the question. I think every Buddhist everybody who chooses this path sincerely has comes up against that a billion times in the course of their In the beginning, let's put it this way. I've been doing this a long time, and my practice has waxed and waned, and sometimes, I've been able to really have a lot of time to practice, and then other times I haven't had as much. And now you have to kind of, obviously the goal is to integrate every moment of your life into the practice. So that's not really a problem, because this is your only life, and the fact that interest in, let's put it this way, if I was Lama Zopa, which I can't even imagine, because I can't say what he says. He says stuff all the time that I'm amazed at, but he will say, that means what you're describing is actually kind of good. That your interest in superfluous things that don't have anything to do with transforming your /heart-mind, your disinterest in that is part of your renunciation. It's just a natural process of the practice. You realize that the mind is transformable. You're beginning to suffer less and see the possibility of freedom, right? Even though it might be small, there's a little bit of a light there. And so, gradually, and I've just seen a lot of people come into this center and they get all like, wow, this is so great. And then 6 months later, you don't see them anymore because they burned out, or they made a lot of mistaken assumptions. So I think one of the key things is you go at your own pace. You know, you don't even have to be a Buddhist to be here, obviously. At some point, if you choose to be a Buddhist, anybody, it always, as you know, it helps to make a commitment, doesn't it? I mean, if you're just kind of dawdling or, you know, just kind of tasting things, but you're really not committed, well, that's like being in a relationship. It's not as satisfying as a full-on commitment. No back doors, you know, I'm here for the duration. This is my path, and I've examined it carefully and so forth. So I think having that kind of mindset can be helpful. Now, what was I going to say? Other than it's really, I think it's very helpful to acknowledge, you know, where you are, and then every morning you get up and you try your best. You set your motivation in the beginning of the day to have the whole day be Dharma. And then, if you went to the, did you go to the Light of the Path retreat?
I didn't go to the Light of the Path. I went to other retreats at Nolan's Farm and everything. But I could understand that if it were a situation that, okay, 6 months in, because when I was 6 months in, I was bouncing off the walls. But this is what, going into the fifth year or something, and it hasn't dissipated. It has calmed somewhat. I'm not grabbing everybody and asking a million questions, right? but it's still there. This sense of urgency, this sense of I need to get this, and constantly, it's a constant thing. And like I said, I can understand if it were a situation where it was just a few months and everything is fabulously shiny new. But it's still shiny new.
Yeah. Well, I don't, you know, again, I don't see this, what you're describing. I mean, if it's causing you to suffer, then that's
it's
one
thing.
It's
not causing me to
but
suffer.
If, but if it's a stimulus for you to practice and it's keeping you interested and keeping you engaged, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I know some people that are alcoholics, and they go to AA meetings 2 and 3 times a day because their addictions are so strong. You know, the negative habit is so strong that they need to go and hear the message 3 times a day, and to be in a supportive environment 3 times a day, and check in with their sponsor 3 times a day or 4 times a day, and they need to do that for years and years to change their mind. That's, you know, now our lives, we spend at least a third sleeping, you know, at this point, at least a third or more working, and at least probably another, let me get my percentages right here, but a lot of time wasted watching TV and hanging out and just, you know, chit-chatting. You know, in the grand scheme of things, we don't have forever, do we? And the amount of time that we put into formal Dharma practice, which is like coming here or doing your sitting practice in the morning, that's very small. So we have to be able to take the rest of our lives and have that be part of our Dharma practice too. So Lama Zopa, I mean, there's stories of these great Buddhist saints. Does anybody, Tong Lin is this practice called taking and giving, where you imagine breathing in the suffering of others and breathing out loving kindness and happiness. You know, there are these Buddhist monks, and you don't have to be a monk to practice Tonglin 20, you know, literally day and night, 24/7. You know, these great practitioners practice Tonglin 24/7. They really tried to pay attention to their mind. And Lama Atisha, when he was in Tibet, he's the founder he was the reviver of Tibetan Buddhism and the founder of the Kadam tradition that our center comes from. When he was riding around in Tibet on his horse going from monastery to monastery, he was always watching his mind, And as soon as a negative thought came into his mind, what did he do?
Stop and purify immediately.
He would stop, get off his horse, put his stupa down, and do prostrations and try to generate regret, remorse, and vow not to do it again, and purify it immediately. That was his... So, I mean, we have these great examples of people that seem nuts because they... But if you really take this path to heart, and you really want to be happy, and if it is possible to shape our minds by the decisions and choices we make, which I don't think many people have a problem with, I think we can all see that or have some instinct about it. This is a path that's 2,600 years old. Many people have followed it. They've tried to, you know, some people it doesn't work for them. They go right down the street to wherever they go, and that's perfectly legitimate. This is not for everybody. We don't claim that if you're not a Buddhist, you're going to hell. We're probably all going to hell, but that's another story. Yeah, we've been to hell, and we might be going back soon. But you know, it's not for everybody. And if it resonates with us, then there's a, and you want to practice, then there's ways to get more and more involved in it. You know, and there's the sutra path. And then for people that have the good fortune and the good karma and the whatever it takes to be introduced to Tantra, that's like the most amazing, you know, sort of transformative path of all. But so not easy to even meet it and then to be able to practice it, it's even more rare. So you know, and I have nothing else to say. But I'll get close to answering your question.
It's pretty normal on the path to be like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it's normal to talk to other people who are not Buddhist, and they're just having a normal conversation. And then in my mind, I'm going, oh, that's a secondary delusion. That's one of the 51 mental factors. And that's a secondary delusion. And analyzing everything like that.
Yeah, I think it's great. Because then you're identifying what you don't want to do, what you don't want to say. If you see somebody who's being, who's like, they're engaging in one of the negative mental factors like greed, hatred, whatever the one, whatever one, you know, pick one. And, you know, you go, wow, I've done that before. This is only going to cause them to suffer. Man, I don't want to do that again. Or if you do it, this is more, even more important. Is if you understand the mind and mental, you know, there's a teaching which George Chernoff gave on mind and mental factors. The 51 minds and mental factors, but anyway, there's a set of about 16, well, there's secondary too. There's a whole bunch of negative ones. But it's only when you study this and you go, wow, I didn't even realize that that was negative, for example, that agitation, you know, excitement, mental excitement, there's one for you. That's a negative mental factor. I want to get excited. You know, we spend a lot of money for excitement, right? And yet the mind and mental factor says anything that disturbs our mind and distracts it from peace and tranquility is considered to be a, quote, negative mental factor or this harmful... Anyway, what I say is great. Keep it going, but I think it's okay. I really think it's a sign that your practice is working. That's what I'd say. By the way, they say that as soon as you become a Buddhist, you think all of a sudden your problems are going to go away. They do that. A lot of the teachers say, look. As soon as you become a Buddhist, it's like opening the door to problems. They just come marching in. They line up. They queue up, ready to give you the work you need to transform your mind. So, being a Buddhist is again, I think it's you know, it's important at some point to. I'm not even going to say that. I think that making a commitment to anything really helps you get much deeper into it, right? Whether it be in a relationship or a job or a spiritual path. And in dabbling, being like a spiritual dilettante, you know, where you just dabble in this and that, and you never get very deep into anything, that's what you get. It's just a mediocre experience of everything. So I think at some point, for people who are interested in Buddhism and have been practicing it for a while and have checked it out and are clear that there's no other path that makes sense to them, it helps to make the commitment. But it's not for everybody. And it's and nobody's pushing. You know, everybody has to make their own, do it in their own good time. Because it's really not good to turn back on any, it's like cheating on your spouse or getting a divorce. I mean, that's really painful, isn't it? That hurts. And it harms our karma to do that, and it harms our karma to commit to a spiritual path and then to say, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. You know? So, anyway. Any other questions? We've still got a few minutes here. Yeah.
I was just going to ask about, like, work stress.
What?
Work stress.
Okay.
So, you know, getting overwhelmed, feeling like you can't get it all done or do it well enough, and those kinds of things. If we have time, I don't know what time it is.
No, we have time. Work stress, being overwhelmed. How many people have that? So we ought to be able to get some help from some of the people around here, too. See if Lama's up. I have an answer, but I want to see if Shay has. Let's see if he has. I know he's got terrorism here. Money. Martha Stewart? George Bush? Sorry. Earthquakes? Oh, no work stress. Sorry. Cockroaches? Babies? Attachment? Oh, well. Al Gore? Oh, my gosh. All right. Here's my answer to work stress. Let's see. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is, could somebody do your job and not be stressed? Is that possible? Yeah. So it's not actually the job. I mean, if a Martian were looking at you and filming your day, you know, they would. There's nothing inherently stressful about your job. It's just you. I mean, you're just doing a series of things. And wait a minute now. And you just told me it's possible to do your job without stress. So I'm just saying, you know, if somebody's videoing your day, it's just a series of activities, one after another. But at the end of the day, you label that, or some place during the day and throughout the day, you see that as stressful. Well, is stress in the job, or is that coming from your mind?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think it's definitely coming from the mind, like any kind of unhappiness.
So what is it, what's underneath that? That's causing you to feel stressed.
So it's, I mean, ego. I mean, it's worried about how I'm going to be perceived by others, or how I'm going to be successful, or, you know, how it's going to reflect on me, or that I'm going to get it all done. And I think that's where it all kind of comes back to.
So you're, what I'm hearing you say is that that you're attached to looking good. And you're attached to getting it done, and to get it done in excellence. And the more you're attached to that, what are you afraid of?
Not getting it.
Not getting it done, not looking good, and so on. So there, the fear of not looking good and all that is there in the same moment that there's the attachment to looking good and getting it done, right? The fear is the flip side of the coin. So it's there in the same moment. The more we're attached to deliciousness in this sense, looking good and getting your job done and being thought of as a competent person in your job, the more we're attached to that, the more we fear the opposite. So it's there in the moment. And that whole experience is we're labeling stress. Does that sound right? And it is underpinned by ego. Ego is there, no doubt. It's there. So what's the remedy?
I mean, if you can, you know, realize emptiness of self and kind of let it all go, that'll work.
A while. Yeah, letting it go. Letting it go. Recognizing in the moment that you're feeling stress, what do you need to do? You're sitting there and you're doing, you think, I'm stressed. This is so stressful. That's where awareness practice comes in. And then you go, and one of the ways you know things aren't going well is you don't feel good. You feel yucky. There's a negative, there's a bad feeling associated with being stressed, isn't it? So you don't feel good. If we define feeling as positive, negative, or neutral, this is a negative feeling, and the experience is, I don't like this, right? So we have to pay attention. This gets back to your question. You know, day after day, all day long, Dharma practice never stops. So if you pay attention and you see that you're stressed out, there are things that can be done.
One other part of it is sometimes I think even harder to let go of is if I'm going to disappoint or negatively impact somebody else. And then that's kind of harder to deal with sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. But again, it's what the mind is clinging to concepts. Am I going to disappoint? Am I going to do it right? The mind's clinging to concepts. Noticing, I'm not saying that these things don't rise in your mind, but noticing that I'm concerned about making a mistake, I'm concerned about looking bad, I'm concerned about messing somebody else up, noticing the mind and being aware of those things are all true, right? But not clinging to them and creating a problem that we label stress because of these thoughts. But seeing them as, and not even having, you know, one of the practices in a tradition called Vipassana is to see that thoughts, when thoughts arise, that they're not me. Those thoughts just come in, you know, they just come into awareness. They're, I see that. I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to mess anybody else. And man, I'm really stressed out and, my mind's distracted. I need to be looking at this person and listening to them, and I'm off on some fantasy trip. I need to come back like that. So, you know, that's really where the rubber meets the road. You know, it's in day-to-day practice is not easy. Not easy. But when we begin to see how attachment is not our friend, clinging is not our friend. Now, in Buddhism, are we saying that attachment is bad or wrong? You heard me say that? I'm real clear it's not wrong. It's not even bad. But it does cause suffering. And so maybe you could call it wrong and bad from that perspective. Attachment is not wrong. We're going to do it. As long as we have a sense of self, a reified sense of self, which we're going to have for a long, long time, then it behooves us to try to be aware of it, and as much as possible, when our ego is running the trip, self-centeredness, self-cherishing selfishness is driving the conversation, to try to recognize that and let go. Let go. And sometimes we need some reasoning to let go. Like remembering karma. Like somebody at work, your boss, like, tells you you're doing a terrible job and you screwed up this project, and you go, well, you know, it wasn't even me. This this guy that's working for me screwed up the project, and I'm, you know, it wasn't even me. You know, I'm a victim, and I don't deserve to be treated this way, and on and on and on. Well, you know, having a view of reality that says I'm responsible for everything, and I can work with this, right? It's a karmic, the fruit of past actions, and now I have an opportunity to transform my mind if I handle this skillfully. You know, it's a completely different attitude than the egocentric, reactive life that we most people live on automatic pilot. So it's called waking up to reality, waking up to your life, moment to moment. Cannot, you know, and this is, like I said, it's not the easy path, is it? Because it requires vigilance and it requires a commitment to your happiness, which we all want. But we think it's like something that just descends on us. But in Buddhism it says, no, we can shape our mind any way we want it. If we want to shape our experience to see our lives as workable and our mind is happy and our even right up to our death, to the process of dying and death, we do not have, it may be painful, but we don't have to suffer. If we have the kind of mind that can let go, that can see reality as it is, we can experience every moment of our life as a blissful awareness as possible. That's the claim. And, of course, we have to start wherever we are. But it's a good question. What gets labeled stressful? A lot. All right. Somebody in the back here. We've come this side of the... Oh, we are. My goodness. What time are we supposed to quit? I thought it was 11:30. Sorry. 10:30. Okay. So let's do the... let's do the prayers. The dedication prayers on page 36. So we do 36, 37, and then down, oh wait a minute, I'm sorry, wrong page. No, dedication prayers. 36, Ramazopa, and then, and then down to the, Meksema. What is Geshe Kinsa Rinpoche, where is his long life prayer? I don't want to leave Geshe Gelug's teacher out. Anyway, we'll do the short Meksema. Okay? All right. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chinrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And then we'll do it in English. Avalokitesvara, great treasure of non-objectifying compassion, Manjushri, master of stainless wisdom, Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the sages of the land of snows, Tulabhsandrapa, at your feet I make request. And then we'll do, Ravi, why don't you lead us in the Green Tara mantra, for Geshe Gelug's long life. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. 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 Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Soha. Okay. Okay, thank you for your attention. Now, I'm trying to institute a new tradition at Kadab Center where we actually talk to people before we walk out of the Gompa. So if you could introduce yourself to somebody that maybe you don't know well, just shake their hand and wish them a good day and a happy life and good karma, whatever. But just shake a hand before you leave, please. You can do that now. I think at the Christian churches they say, may peace be with you. That'd be good too.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we've met before.